Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and once again, please bear with me today. I'm still sorting out my audio stuff, so I'm way too echoey. I was listening to some of it yesterday, and it wasn't great. But anyway, we're joined today on the show by Tiecho Tsotse. Tiecho, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good things, and how are you, sir? Good afternoon, Herman, sir.
Sure. I am very good, all things considered. And we also have Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I think we're all, it's a weird time of the year. I think we're all sort of starting to get a point of just, sustained exhaustion in a very weird way, where we're starting to look forward to being less exhausted.
Yes, no. And it is, of course, as everyone knows, the 1st of November today. So we are creeping slowly but steadily towards the end of the year. And I think, once again, I'm looking forward to it very much. The Daily French Show will not be in operation for December, and then it'll come back in the second week of January.
For everyone that we all know, yesterday was an important, significant day for many people who celebrate it around the world. So happy Reformation Day, everyone.
Indeed. Okay, so let's jump to our first story today, and this is about the National Lotteries Commission, which, due to some reporting by Ground Up, and this follows on more reporting, I believe, also by Ground Up, about the absolute state of corruption and misallocation of funds in the National Lotteries Commission. So it had to allocate another 65 million rand to a number of projects that the lottery was supposed to. So the lotteries have to give 65 million additional rands to these projects, which it was supposed to have finished with its funding a while ago. It was working on a whole number of infrastructure projects, including 4 old age homes and a drug rehabilitation center, none of which were completed because apparently all of the money has been stolen. They also say that they were going to be blacklisting the companies which were responsible for not delivering and investigating them. And currently, a huge number of projects that the lottery was supposed to be funding are under investigation by the Special Investigating Unit and the Hawks. So this is not new from the lottery. I think the past 2 years or so, we've continued to see more and more stories about the staggering scale of corruption that's been going on with the lottery. So for those who are not aware, the government runs the National Lottery, and the proceeds from that lottery are supposed to go towards various charity projects around the country. They're supposed to go towards, in this case, old age homes, drug rehabilitation centers, creches, just kind of anything that might help people. And this is to sort of hopefully turn the proceeds of gambling into something that's quite useful. However, it seems to have just become another sort of patronage tool that government can scoop up. So, Tiecho, let me start with you. What do you make of this? And what do you make of the argument that we shouldn't actually have a lottery at all? The argument goes essentially that the people who most are invested in the lottery and who tend to play it the most are those who are very poor and don't see any other way of getting their finances altogether and being able to escape poverty, so they start paying the lottery. And essentially, the lottery is kind of a tax on poor people because your chances of actually winning the lottery are extremely low. What do you make of all this, Tiecho?
Sure. Well, the first point would be that, when I read this article, it shocked me that there are still organizations that provide proactive grants or proactive funding for projects such as the ones that you've spoken about here. In South Africa, we have had so many cases of corruption whereby many money and proactive grants refer to grants whereby money is given to a company beforehand to perform a certain project, build a project or something of that nature. And in departments, municipalities, that in particular has long stopped because many people were allocated money beforehand and they chowed the money, did not end up using the money for what it should be used. I saw in one of the stories, particularly relating to the rehabilitation center that they were building, around 22 million was granted and only I think it was 5.4 million, only 5.4 million was spent on the actual project. The rest of the money was taken away. What's logical is that if you are going to grant people money, you need to come up with a criteria of some sort. You give them in bits and pieces. You hire a company that has the funds. They build to this extent. You then provide them with the funding for what they have built. After evaluating and seeing that they've built what they said they would build with the material that they said they had said they would build with. So I think first it's crazy that in 2022, South Africa, after all that has happened, so many projects incomplete in the country, we still have an organization providing such grants. Secondly, regarding the issue of perhaps doing away with the National Lotteries Commission because the poor tend to spend more on it and don't get their money back, I don't know. I don't think my mind is made up around that yet. At the same time, I'm thinking about the fact that the poor, many of them who play this and those who are eligible to play these games are adults who can make choices for themselves. If this is something that's in demand and people really do want to play this, I mean, if we did away with the National Lotteries Commission, people will still go to Hollywood, Betway. You still have these games going on there from other countries and stuff of that nature. I think perhaps let's have it. And if someone goes around spending that money towards playing with that money and losing that money, I guess they are adults who have made a choice and must live with the consequences of that choice. We mustn't feel sorry for them then and try to help them because they made the choice themselves to blow the money.
Herman, what do you make of all this mess? And do you agree with Tiako about leaving it up to people to make the choice?
Yes and no. Partly because I mean, it's of course free. Anyone's free to make these sorts of choices in adults. But I don't see why a national lottery that has government involvement and that has, you know, sort of as operates as a quango for government activities, and I don't know why that is supposed to be involved. If you want to run a lottery, please do it. But I do think this even centralizing legal gambling seems to be a rather perverse thing, and I do think it is a tax on the poor. I'm not saying that means, of course, that we have to deny the agency of the poor. I just think, you know, it is there are some questions that we should ask from a moral perspective. Is this morally useful? Does it contribute? Is the state's involvement in this actually furthering of any of its core mandates? And I don't see that. I highly doubt that. But I must say, what struck me about this is that, and Tiego alluded to it, is that the oversight for how millions is spent is essentially non-existent. That ground up sort of an investigative unit had to come up with this, had to find this data, had to expend their resources rather than any of the formal oversight institutions, I think is embarrassing. But I mean, this is just another example, another state failure, another situation where corruption is just accepted. And, you know, the who was it, Philemon Letwaba, who there was this old age home in Mpumalanga, Marapyane, that was supposed to be built. And some of the money intended for the project went to this former National Lottery Commission Chief Operating Officer, Philemon Letwaba, nearby. He built his house with some of that money. And I just think, you know, this small fry in a way. This is 23.7 million. It's minor. In the bigger scheme of things, it no one should really lose sleep about this. If you look at the scale of state capture, then 37 million is actually quite small. But the thing that makes it so harrowing is that what led to the 37 million rand and what led to 37 billion rand being stolen, being up for looting, is exactly the same attitude and the same structure, the same gangster mafioso mentality, that there are some people in this country who are politically connected and are politically elite, and therefore, through rigging the system in favor of themselves, they can do anything, whether it is something as minor as I know there's a municipality in the Northwest where a local nature reserve, the mayor moved some of his cattle to graze in the local nature reserve. Whether it's sort of a minor corruption where the mayor can just decide, oh, you know, I have some cattle, let me just use public grounds to have them kept safe and have them fed, and, you know, let me graze on the public expense, whether it's something as relatively ridiculous as that, whether it is the rumors that we've heard so many times that Supramo Mapelo essentially owns many of the shopping malls in which many of Northwest's provincial government actually have their departmental offices, whether it's stealing a few million from the National Lottery Commission to build your own house, or whether it is, you know, scaling it up all the way past Nkandla, all the way to the biggest scandal you could possibly think of. What causes this is the same. It is a political elite that has so isolated themselves from accountability through the hollowing out of institutions, and did so through things like CADA deployment and BEE. So this, in a, South Africans shouldn't actually, you know, see these few million rands as anything more than a hiccup. 60 million rand in the great scheme of things, how minor. But the problem is, what led to that is the same thing that led to the last 15, 20 years of legalized looting. And we're now at a point where it's very real. The results, we can no longer pretend that this is a victimless crime. It's going to start hitting home more aggressively, probably in various ways, service delivery failures and also political assassinations. So yeah, it's just depressing that yet this tax on the poor is just, you know, another excuse to Smits Ngonyama, former communications director of the ANC, said that he didn't participate in the struggle to be poor. And that is, that mentality dominates.
Yes, I feel like it would be useful if someone who stole money from an old age home should spend their prison sentence looking after the same old people in the old age home once it's completed. Might be a nice, useful form of penance. Anyway, Tiego, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
Well, my final thoughts around this would go toward the quote that Herman speaks about, that I am very convinced that perhaps the ANC was not in the struggle to really fix things. Perhaps they were in the struggle to remove those who were in charge of apartheid so they could be on those seats and benefit from it. And this could very well, this is quite clearly one of the projects. The NLC is one of those projects that they are using to chow money from the state and from our purses as citizens. So again, I come back and say, come 2024, let's please make the right decisions.
A very, very brief point on this. We should be aware that quite often people talk about factions within the ANC as if there's a good faction, a bad faction. I just want to reiterate that the ANC is divided into two main factions, the people who want to take your money and the people who want to steal your money. So it really comes down to a question of there's no rehabilitation for this movement. There's no rehabilitation for this party. And if the voters can't suffer enough for that reality to manifest, then it's sort of that democracies get the governments they deserve.
It's a very dark note to end on, but we will come back to elections later on in the show. Very briefly, I don't think there's too much to say about this, except that it's just kind of frustrating, but also amusing what's been going on. This is our second story, which is our current public protector who, what is she, suspended or not suspended now? I must say I have lost track of the story somewhat because she has been so caught up in legal problems and legal issues. Busisiwe Mkhwebane is currently facing a hearing as to see whether she is going to be impeached from her position as the public protector. However, it seems an awful lot to me like she's adopting the tactics of President Jacob Zuma when it comes to law and adopting a sort of what might call Stalingrad approach to these legal proceedings. She keeps asking for extensions of timelines, of postponements of the hearings. Last week she said that she needed time to consult her legal team, and so managed to get the hearing suspended from yesterday, sorry, from Friday until today, when they've started up again. And now there's debate to whether the hearings can go ahead at all, because she says, no, my lawyers are busy preparing documents for me in a different case at the Constitutional Court, so they can't represent me here, and it's not fair to not have me represented here. The EFF has been helping her along this whole time by saying that they will not, Darlene Porfu or said that he would, and some of the EFF said they would leave the committee and not participate in these hearings if she was not granted postponements and extensions to sort out her own legal matters. And this really gives me a bit of a whiff of that that same thing that we've seen from Jacob Zuma for so many years, of you just endlessly postpone, you wait till the last day to appeal, you appeal something, then you fire your legal team, then you spend a month getting a new legal team. That approach, what so many have definitely called the Stalingrad approach. Tiago, what do you make of this? I mean, this is just endlessly frustrating. Do you think she's going to succeed in running out the clock until, I don't know, the political circumstances change in her favor?
I think she's trying to arrive at October next year. If I'm not mistaken, her term as a public protector expires next year in October. So she's probably trying to protect her pension funds, given that, yeah, if she manages to complete her term next year, she can keep her pensions and everything of that nature. But if she's removed now, then that goes away. I think that's what she's doing here. And of course, she is Mukwevani is of course a political weapon of some sort, that's used by the RET faction of the ANC, brought in by Jacob Zuma. And of course, Jacob Zuma is a kind of person, when he made appointments as a president, he made them to favor him and his comrades and stuff of that nature. If you look at when he came in as president, was it in 2008, right? When he came in as president at the time, he got rid of 2009, so got rid of Scorpions, got rid of the director of the NPA, brought in people who would protect him and stuff of that nature. So Mgwabane should be seen as that kind of a person who's been brought in to fight political battles, and someone who's a disciple in a way of Zuma. And so it's not shocking at all that she's applying the same tactics that Zuma has been applying over the years. But I'm convinced she's trying to get to next year, October.
I think that's a pretty good guess. Herman, thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think Tiago is probably broadly right. Something that we should also consider is this sort of illustrates my aversion to Chapter 9 institutions as a general rule. I think, you know, one or two of them are useful. But the problem is that Chapter 9 institutions like the South African Human Rights Commission, like the Public Protector, were written into the 1996 Constitution in a well-intentioned but I think rather naive attempt to protect the citizens from themselves, to have extra constitutional checks and balances. But the problem is that these checks and balances are essentially state controlled. And the red lights for me began flashing with Mkhwebane when, during the interview process, she described the position of the public protector as being there to assist the state, there to assist the government of the day. And yet they still confirmed her. Someone so fundamentally unqualified, so fundamentally uninformed about what the role of a public protector might be. But I think it's not really her fault that the Chapter 9 institutions are at the same time both too weak and too strong, because we had Thulima Mmsela give us an episode of typical South African personality politics hero worship, where everything she touched turned to, you know, Thuli gold. It was just like, oh, and I remember the Facebook groups and the specific comments of a specific you know, section of people just going, oh, Tuli for president. And then I'm just like, you know that we have, firstly, we have very little idea as to what her ideological opinions are. We now know that she's an absolute, you know, wokista and someone of the CRT transformation, anti-racist, racialist school, but she couches it in very, you know, soft-spoken, nice, you know, terminology. So well done her. But the problem is that she was so deified that even the Constitutional Court fell for it, that they essentially elevated the Office of the Public Protector to a high court judge status, where she could make findings binding in law. Now, the absurdity of that is, once you are going to create a quasi-judicial entity that you then elevate to such an extent that it becomes a little mini court with a one-person judge, and that one person is appointed by the executive and the legislature, then you've just created the ideal opportunity for another little bit of state capture. If we had spent every single resource that had been spent on the public protector, because before Mkhwebane, nothing to write home about. After Mkhwebane, several things to write home about, but mostly in tears or laughter. But if we had spent every single element of rand, every cent that we'd spent on the public protector these last few years, boosting the National Prosecuting Authority, bring back the scorpions, then these Chapter 9 nonsense institutions, these sort of constitutional feel-good gimmicks wouldn't be necessary in the first place. And I think the well-intentionedness of trying to preserve the voters from their own decisions is now really coming back to bite all South Africans. It's not necessary to have a public protector if you allow people to be active in a constitutional democracy. As long as you've got these nonsense entities out there that can, you know, shield the voter from some of the consequences of their own decisions, of course you're going to incentivize crap government, because government isn't held to a standard anymore by the electorate, because the electorate can just, you know, outsource it to the public protector. The electorate no longer has to think, my goodness, wasn't Kandla a good or a bad idea? No, that has to be outsourced to a Chapter 9 institution that gives the dominant political party the opportunity to say, no, we've dealt with it. Look, there's a report, we've dealt with it. And the voter can just go, okay, well, it's been dealt with. It's out of my hands now. So I do think there's a fundamental constitutional question here as to whether the South Africans who vote in elections actually care enough about the country to avoid the embarrassment of a repeat performance of Busisiwe and Mkhwebane.
Tiego, very briefly, any final thoughts on this?
Well, like I said the other day, after Herman has spoken, I can't come after that. I am in agreement with everything he has said. He has said a mouthful, yeah.
Indeed. I agree with your point on the Chapter 9 institutions. You know, we've got a lot of very good things in our constitution, but we've also got some things, I think, that could maybe be tweaked a little bit. But anyway, all right, enough about South Africa. Let's go overseas and talk about, well, gentlemen, we've got three potential elections we can talk about. The upcoming American midterms, the Brazilian presidential and legislature elections, which just happened, or the upcoming Israeli election. I don't know, which one would you guys prefer to talk about?
Let me quickly say one thing on the Israeli and the Brazilian elections, and then we could perhaps park a little bit at the US elections, because I think they're more interesting. Number one is the Israeli elections. This is the fourth election in 5 years.
They're going to be world champions at voting soon.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's wonderful. I mean, the experience one just gets. So the problem that or the thing that South Africans should take from that is that the Johannesburg narrative and experience, and the election, and then the destruction, and then the resurrection, and then the impending doom of a government in a coalition system is something that is up to the voter. It really is up to the voter to determine whether a constitution or a coalition government can actually succeed. If voters don't allow for their choices to actually be taken seriously by themselves and the political parties, we're heading to an Israel situation where no government of any constellation could possibly survive. Now, that might not be a terribly bad thing. Some South Africans would absolutely kill for a paralyzed government, because on some days it might be fantastic if we could just get the government to stop doing anything.
Yes, that would stop putting its boot on our heads and stamping.
Yes, I mean, we will pay you to do nothing. But then on the Brazilian election front, I do think that there we see something quite telling, is that we've gone from a relatively hard right government president to a relatively hard left president. On one level, that's sort of concerning, that the idea of moderation, either from the left or the right, has become untenable. But on the other hand, it shows, due to, Larimer, your insights from before we started recording here, is divided government, where you have these various spheres of government controlled by various centers of power, is sometimes a good thing. So remember that when we talk about the US elections and when we talk about the gridlock in the US and sort of the how nothing is happening because the two houses of Congress can't agree with each other and can't agree with the president, sometimes that's a bloody good situation for citizens to be in. If the idea is that government should be limited, there's no better check on government power than putting government against itself.
And just on that point of divided government in Brazil, the Chamber of Deputies, which is the main lower house of Brazil in their legislature, the largest party, which is actually Bolsonaro's party, even though he lost the presidential election, got 99 out of 513 seats. And the second biggest party, which is Lula's party, Brazil of Hope, got about 79 seats. So that is, if those are the biggest parties, you can imagine how split that legislature is going to be and the kind of sort of coalitions they're going to have to get together to pass legislation. But let's briefly talk about the US midterms. So it's been a sort of an interesting pattern. A year ago, the conventional wisdom was the Republicans are going to absolutely storm through the House of Representatives, which is the US's lower house in the legislature. And they're probably going to win the Senate, too. Then we had this sort of surge in polling for the Democrats, which peaked, I think, somewhere around September. And it looked for a moment as though the Democrats would still lose the House, but only very narrowly, and would more than likely not take the Senate. However, gravity seems to be reasserting itself. And based on the polling, based on the environment, based on the way the candidates have been performing, my gut feeling is that the advantage is definitely to the Republicans, and that they will very likely, almost certainly, I think, win the House of Representatives. And when it comes to the Senate, they may manage to just eke out enough seats. Now, because the American Senate has an even number of senators, all ties in it are broken by the vice president. So in order for the Republicans to take control of the chamber, they will need to get 51 seats rather than 50 seats, whereas the Democrats only need 50 because the Vice President Kamala Harris breaks the ties. So, Herman, let me start with you again. Do you think I'm right in that assessment? Do you think the Republicans are probably going to take it in this one? I reckon it'll be pretty close in the Senate. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's quite right. A year ago, as you say, the expectation was the Republicans would walk this, but something happened in between. Much of that is called, you know, two important things. You've got the Dobbs decision that on the constitutional right to abortion, but then you also have the spectacle of Donald Trump. Many very, very, you know, toss-up states were nudged in favor of the Democrats by Trump-nominated candidates or Trump-endorsed candidates becoming the Republican candidates if the Republicans win back the House
and Senate. Namely Herschel Walker in Georgia and
Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania,
yes. Although, can I just say the Pennsylvania race is such a mess because you've got Mehmet Oz, who is this sort of strange character. I think he was originally on the Oprah show. He's like a TV doctor. And then you've got his opponent, Fetterman. What's his first name?
John
Fetterman, who had a massive stroke in May and has serious auditory and health problems ever since. So if I was a Pennsylvania voter, I wouldn't be too enthusiastic about my choice.
No, I mean, and what we could go on about on for quite a while about the nonsense of the Pennsylvania race, but I must say that just very, very briefly, if the Republicans win back the House and the Senate, it will be despite Donald Trump, not due or thanks to Donald Trump. He has, since 2020, he has underperformed the Republican Party, and the Republican Party play with fire if they allow someone less popular than the party itself to drag them into a specific ideological direction. Now, the problem is, if people like Oz win in Pennsylvania, Trump will see that as an endorsement of a Trumpist program and probably come out swinging for 2024. The Republican in me wants the man to accept when his, you know, when the curtain has fallen, and allow for more capable politicians like Ron DeSantis perhaps to take over and take the Republican flag forward.
Diego, do you have anything to add before we close up?
Nothing to add, sir. You can close.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, and thank you to everyone for listening. We will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. I hope you all have a wonderful, fantastic day. Cheers, everyone.